Chapter 28. Goodman got the bare bones of the story from Sorensen and said, "What about my missing eyewitness?" Sorensen said,
"You can handle that yourself for the rest of the night. But don't worry, you're about to get plenty of help. As soon as the office workers get in tomorrow, I'll be replaced and you'll be knee-deep in agents. You'll have so many here you can put a couple on traffic duty. You can find out who drops gum on the sidewalk."
"Your SAC is already involved, and you haven't been replaced yet."
"He hasn't kicked it upstairs yet. Can't do that in the middle of the night, but he will. And he'll cover his ass. Right now I bet he's writing a report which will be in every email inbox everywhere by the time the sun comes up, and the last paragraph will be a recommendation to pull me out and bring in the heavy hitters from D.C. You can take that to the bank."
"Doesn't he trust you?"
"Oh, he trusts me just fine. But this thing looks toxic. He won't want it anywhere near his own office. He prefers to look good."
"So why are you going to Iowa?"
"Because right now it's still my case."
"You really think it's them?"
"The location is right. It's about where they'd be by now."
"That's just a wild-ass guess."
"Who else would call Omaha from east of Des Moines?"
"Why would they call at all? And from a traceable payphone?"
"A secret conscience attack, maybe? By the driver, possibly? They tell me the voice was nasal, which could be a busted nose, not the flu. And maybe a payphone was all he could find."
"But he hung up." Sorensen nodded.
"He changed his mind. That can happen."
Goodman said, "What about Karen Del Fuenzo's daughter?"
"You'll have to tell her. You'd have to anyway. This is your county, and she's your people."
"When should I tell her?"
"When she wakes up."
"That's gonna be tough."
"It always is."
"Those guys will be long gone by the time you get to southeastern Iowa. It's a long way away."
"I can drive faster than they did. No more roadblocks, and I don't have to worry about tickets."
"Even so."
"Whatever. It's better than staying here doing nothing,"
Sorensen said. Sorensen checked in with Dawson and Mitchell and told them what she was gonna do. She didn't offer them a ride. She expected them to follow in their own car. She thought big-deal counterterrorism agents would relish the chase. But they said they were going to stay put right there in the wilds of Nebraska, near the point of vulnerability. They said there was nothing to worry about in Iowa. No disrespect to that fine state, they said, but it wasn't a prime terrorist target. Sorensen said,
"They could have a base camp there, like a hideout."
Mitchell said, "Are you serious?"
"Not really."
Dawson nodded. "We'll call St. Louis. Technically, southeastern Iowa is their responsibility. They'll get involved if they need to." Sorensen didn't speak to Lester L. Lester, Jr. of the State Department. She just ignored him completely. She got a ride with Goodman back to the old pumping station, and she got back in her car, and she followed her GPS back to the interstate, 70 miles an hour all the way, with her lights flashing and her cell phone charging. A deceptive exit, Reacher thought again. Dark rural roads and places that were shut when you got there. He had been wrong about the gas station, but in and of itself, that didn't make the motel any more likely to exist. 50-50 was a reasonable outcome where truth in advertising was concerned. He had seen plenty of abandoned motels on his travels. America was full of them. They were like little time capsules, forever frozen in an earlier era. Sometimes plain, sometimes adventurous in their design, always testament to the long sad decline in their owners' energies and ambitions, always evidence of the way public taste had moved on. A week in a cabin near a buggy lake was no longer enough. Now it was cruises in Vegas and the Virgin Islands. Reacher had seen travel agents' windows. He knew where vacationers went. He knew where they didn't go. He saw no reason why a motel in the wilds of Iowa would have done any business in the last 30 years. Which was a pity, because a stop for the night would have opened up a whole new world of possibilities. King had turned left and right, endlessly south and east through the checkerboard darkness, a total of more than 30 miles since leaving the Shell station. At each turn, a copy of the accommodations board had tempted them onward, the bland little arrows looking both firm and tentative, both promising and hopeless. McQueen didn't look worried. He was awake and vigilant, and he seemed confident. He trusted the signs. And it turned out he was right, too. A mile later, for the second time that night, Reacher was proved wrong. He saw a dull glow in the mist far ahead on the left, and he watched as it resolved itself into separate beige pearls of light, which turned out to be dim electric bulbs and bulkhead fixtures set knee-high on the walls of a long, low motel building. The design of the place was standard. There was dark brown siding, and a lobby and an office at the north end, with a Coke machine and a porte-cochere, and then the building continued south in a regular rhythm, window door, for a total of 12 rooms. Each door had two white plastic lawn chairs next to it. The low-set bulkhead fixtures were to light a sidewalk that ran the length of the building. Two rooms had cars parked outside, one an old sedan, lacy with rust, and the other an immense pickup truck painted in a motorcycle manufacturer's colors. There was a third car parked tight against the office wall, a three-door import not much bigger than a golf cart. The night clerk's ride, presumably. Alan King slowed the Chevy and stopped and idled on the road 20 feet from the motel's entrance. He surveyed the place carefully, end to end, and he said, "Good enough?" Don McQueen said, "Works for me." King didn't seek Karen Delfuenzo's opinion. There was no big three-way Democratic discussion. He just rolled onward and turned in on the far side of the porte-cochere and came to a stop under it, facing north, with the rooms behind him. Inconvenient, in that he would have to back up or turn around after checking in, but inevitable, in that America drives on the right and takes circles counterclockwise. There was a nightlight burning in the lobby. Reacher could see a reception counter and a closed door behind it that no doubt led to an office. Probably the night guy was in there, asleep in a chair. There was a vase of flowers on the counter, probably fake. Alan King said, "Mr. Reacher, would you go make the inquiry about rooms?" Reacher said, "Obviously there are rooms. There are 12 doors and 2 cars." "Then would you kindly check us in?" Reacher said, "I'm not the best guy to do that." "Why not?" Reacher thought. "Because I don't want to get out of the car. Not now. Because I no longer control the car key." He said, "Because I don't have a credit card."
"Really?"
"Or ID. Apart from an old passport, that is. But it's been expired for years, and some people don't like that."
"Well, you must have a driver's license, surely."
"I don't."
"But you were just driving."
"Don't tell the cops."
"Unlicensed driving is a felony."
"Probably just a misdemeanor."
"Have you ever had a license?"
"Not a civilian license, no."
"Have you ever even passed a test?"
"I guess so. Probably. In the army, possibly."
"You don't remember?"
"I remember learning. I don't remember a test as such." McQueen said, "I'll come with you. I have a credit card." Which worked for Reacher. He didn't want to be out of the car alone, but equally, he didn't want either King or McQueen to select the rooms alone. He wanted some influence over who went where. He opened his door. McQueen opened his door. They got out together. McQueen 10 feet from the lobby, Reacher on the far side of the car. McQueen waited. Reacher looped around the trunk. He paused, gestured right-handed, open palm. "Go ahead, after you." A precaution, not politeness. He didn't want to walk in front of a man with a gun. Not that he thought there was a serious danger of getting shot. Not then and there. Not with a night clerk and at least 2 motel guests within earshot. McQueen went ahead down a decorative path made of broken paving stones jigsawed together. Reacher followed. McQueen pulled the lobby door. Reacher stepped up and held it and gestured again. "After you." McQueen went in. Reacher followed. The lobby had a vinyl floor and 4 gaudy wicker armchairs grouped around a low table. There was a higher table with push-top coffee flasks and stacks of paper cups. There was a rack on the wall with compartments for small folded brochures describing local tourist attractions. It was mostly empty. The reception counter butted up against the side wall on the right. It ended 6 feet short of the wall on the left, near the table with the coffee. There was low TV sound behind the office door and a rim of soft light all around it. McQueen bellied up to the counter on the right, and Reacher came to a stop alongside him on the left.
"Hello?"
McQueen called. No response. McQueen tapped his knuckles on the counter.
"Hello?"
he called again. No response. "Service industries," McQueen said quietly. "Can't beat 'em." He knocked on the counter again, a little louder.
"Hello?"
he said, also a little louder. No response. He glanced left at Reacher and said, "You better go knock on his door." Which would put Reacher in front of the gun for the first time, but there was no natural way to refuse. The route around to the door was to the left, and Reacher was on the left, simple as that. Choreography, geometry, inevitable. So Reacher looped around, between the end of the counter and the table with the coffee, and he stepped into the narrow well behind the counter. He glanced back out through the lobby window. The Chevy was still there under the porte cochere. It hadn't moved. It was idling patiently, just waiting, with white exhaust pooling at the rear. But McQueen had left his car door open. Which was the first warning bell. The second was the sound of feet on vinyl, a fast 1-2 shuffle. Exactly like the sound of a man stepping back and turning sideways. The third warning bell was a fast composite rustle of skin and cotton and wool and metal. Exactly like the sound of something heavy coming out of a pocket. Reacher turned back and faced McQueen and saw nothing beyond the muzzle of a small stainless steel handgun pointing at the center of his face.